Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Michael Anthony Ingram, please help me welcome Sophia Nas to the program. Sophia, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you,
yes.
Michael. It's a great privilege and pleasure to be with you in such perilous times.
Yes, these are difficult, difficult times. So programs like this one potentially give people an opportunity to just breathe and just enjoy good poetry for an hour, if nothing else. All right? Are we ready?
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
Let me ask this question. What is poetry, Sophia?
Poetry is language that has opened itself up. It's opened itself up to infinite possibilities. It has metamorphosed into puzzle and paradox, poultice and pronouncement. But above all, poetry pierces the heart of what it means to be human, a creature of desires beyond material needs. I feel that the greatest provocation of poetry is that its raison d'etre, its reason for being,
yes,
is just to be itself. I mean, if the purpose of step-by-step directions is to get you to a particular destination, the purpose of poetry is the journey itself.
I like that. So maybe this is a little twist on that question. Why is it important?
Well, it's important because it reiterates and celebrates our essential nature as human beings rather than human doings, which is why in times like these, times of great crisis, we reach out to poetry.
Well, please share one of your works.
Okay, so this is a poem that is called April Fool's. As you know, it's the 1st of April.
Yes,
April,
yes, it
Fool's
is.
Day. And also the very first day of National Poetry Writing Month.
Yes.
So
yes,
here
is.
We go. April Fool's. Why does April make us fools? Is it a giddy rush of color across plush green cheeks of hills? Marching's done. It's April. The thrill of a lady in waiting to become languid summer lover, robed in blue twilight, taking forever to fall. Glisten to April. Trill that ephemeral whistle between eardrums. The bird that bears each season, wearing magical plumage on the page. As calla lilies, swans sing in spring, fed on cruelty, poets spread their wings. The end.
How does a poem begin for you with an idea a form or an image?
Very often it begins with an image. You know, any one of these could be triggers. However, you know, I'm a very visual person. It's mm-hmm. almost always something I see that makes me think of something else and starts that train of thought.
You know, as you think about your body of work, what are some of the predominant themes?
Well, I would say that the overarching theme of my work is the transitory nature of our life on Earth and the inevitable loss that such transience engenders. And within this larger framework, my main concerns are how we treat the planet and each other. So ecology, social justice, and gender relations are issues that I continue to examine in my poetry. However, you know, loss doesn't occur in a vacuum. For example, I lost my California home due to wildfires, which were caused by climate change. And climate change is, of course, caused by the emissions of heavy industry that drive our present world order. And, of course, we cannot examine our present world order without looking at colonialism and the persistent inequities that it has created. So, as the great naturalist John Muir said, when we tug at any one thing, we find that it is connected to everything else. So, a deeper examination of any loss brings one face to face with history. So in that sense, you could say that history is also one of the preoccupations of my poetry. And specifically, the root causes of displacement and exile, which were my formative experiences as a writer, as well as the inheritance of loss shared by my family and millions of others on both sides of the border, which was hastily drawn up by the retreating British when they created India and Pakistan in 1947,
the partition, right?
Yes. Right. It's hard for those of us who don't come from these countries to understand that the enormous impact that partition continues to exert in the lives of 1.5 billion people.
Yeah, that's fascinating. To have potentially lived through that era.
My parents' generation, yes.
Well, please share another piece of your work.
Okay, so this is something I wrote very recently. It's called Chrysalis. Well, the bucket list fills up. Water sings, frogs jump in. Skin in the game, a rumor burns your tongue, spring in flames, resurrection's theme, lilies, a social distancing species, outsourcing copulation to bees, benevolent breezes, and you too, uncoupled from the train of thought, its cranky bogeys. On a day like this, when mustard fields, leavened with poppies, above girders locked in cat's cradle, Tama Pius holds a world's blue in place. And sedate, slate, gray sea, a study in placid fluidity. Cell bars stir volumes on the house of cards, blow by blow, tiny death, while the sky, an unmade bed, spilling silk, on a day like this. The end.
That was beautiful. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Now, do you sit and think through every word of every stanza, or do you write freely and allow the words to flow?
Absolutely right. Freely allow the words to flow. I'm very old school. I have a journal, you know, like a cheap little pad of paper that is always my first draft, which is always offline, is I find the phone and all the devices incredibly distracting. And but I will, once I've done that first draft, I will go through multiple revisions and, you know, I'll usually read it aloud. And sometimes when it feels stuck, I'll put it away. Sometimes I put away something for years and years. And, you know, so then something will make me think of that again, and I'll come back to
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, all great writers have great writing influences. Who are some of yours, and what makes them great in your eyes?
Wow. Well, I'm blessed to be bilingual. So my writing influences come from disparate sources. First and foremost, the great poets of the subcontinent, which are Kabir, Ghalib, Fez, to name a few of them. Fez is a huge influence because he was a revolutionary socialist poet with many of the same urgent concerns that continue to consume me. Among the poets that aren't from the subcontinent, I was introduced very early on when I was 17 to Neruda and to Octavio Paz and to Jaime Sabines. So poets from Latin America, then of course feminist poets from America, you know, Dickinson, Whitman, Ginsberg, Audre Lorde, Gwendolyn Brooks. I'm sure I'm forgetting, you know, tons of others, but they're some of early influences. And I continue to read.
What are you reading currently?
Well, currently I'm reading Carolyn Forche. She's a poet who has written the poetry of witness, and her latest book is called In the Lateness of the World. These are also poems about climate change and how our world has been so impacted by everything we've done. I'm also reading Sharon Olds, a fantastic poet. If you get a chance to read her book called Odes, it's amazing.
All right.
So,
her book is amazing.
Sorry?
Her book is amazing?
Yes, it is. Absolutely amazing. Sharon Olds. Definitely recommend her work.
All right. Thank you very much. You know, as we think about poetry, we think about our beginnings as when we first start writing poetry. When did you first start writing, and what made you feel the need to express yourself in this way?
So I first started writing poetry when I was six.
The trigger
for that was that in 1971 there was a second partition when Bangladesh when East Pakistan was no longer there and it became Bangladesh. And when all this was happening, my father was a doctor in the army. He was also the commander of the 14th Division, and he was taken prisoner of war when I was not even six, and then he was a prisoner of war in India for 3 years, and I was separated from him. And that loss was the trigger for my writing, you know. So I had a banyan tree. There was a banyan tree where we lived, and I used to climb up this tree, and this tree was my refuge, and it was also where I started writing.
All right. All right. Please share another piece of your work.
So this one is called Odysseys of an Onion Moon. You know, the moon, of course, has been a perennial source of inspiration for poets throughout the ages. And as we face our present reality of social distancing, we can take comfort in the fact that no matter how far apart we live, we're all gazing upon the same moon. So,
I really like that
statement.
Odysseys
of an Onion Moon. Right. Sorry?
I said I really like that
Odysseys of an Onion Moon. Last night, beneath the warm June window, she dreamt the moon was an onion, wedded to all manner of arts. The full moon onion in cahoots with the child playing hooky from the odious class slipped under an armpit, and hey presto, feverish clouds appeared, fluffy as a sick bed. The destiny of the demi-moon onion was a bit more complex. One half of a twin, forgotten in the rotten cavities of the fridge, she suffered the pain of her sibling nonetheless. Everyone thinks they are crying while slicing flesh and bulb. But really, the lunar onions are just homeless tears waiting for eyes to take them in. An excellent root boat, the hollowing quarter moon, resents being a namesake in the Yankee pocket. Afloat in the indigo sky, he plies his cause, dropping leaflets of protest moonlight deep into the sleepless night. As for the much maligned crescent onion, there is little to tell, except that in Vienna, the croissant moon was made a buttery scapegoat for the defeated Ottomans. It's a popular myth that the onion moon disappears in the dark sky, but actually she dissolves into honey, a magic syrup poured into the hoots of barn owls, the throats of bullfrogs, the sore singing wings of the cicadas. There never seems to be enough onion moon to go around. The end.
Wonderful. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
are back. My name is Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with Sophia Nas. Sophia, so much is happening in the world that, to be honest with you, it's really scary. It's really, really scary. What do you see as the role of a poet in modern day society?
Well, the role of the poet is, it's multifold. It's to have a finger on the pulse of everything that's going on. It's to be a mirror, a witness. And it's also to be poultice and balm. It's to be many, many things. This is the time when we need poetry more than ever.
Yes.
Because this is the language that we reach for when there are emotions running through us that are too complex, that are too overwhelming, that are beyond normal speech. So I was actually about to read this poem, which is called Emergency Room.
Mm.
And recently I had a close relative who was critically ill, and I had to spend some time there. And of course, now with this new pandemic, it's even worse, because if your loved one is critically ill, you aren't even allowed to visit them, which is just awful. Anyways, here is a poem, Emergency Room, and this is dedicated to all of those who have loved ones in critical conditions in hospitals around the world. And it's also dedicated to the heroes of our time, the doctors and nurses who are risking their own lives in order to save ours. Emergency Room. Each sound signature is its own indelible animal. The growl of the disconnected heart monitor slipped through a flick of your finger renders my own blood seismic, mirror to quaking sliver of your body. In the half-light of the hospital room, where angels with no wings fly endless miles, and fear is a sea rising faster than flooding water. You lie under covers, blue as an orphan sky, fish from a faraway ocean hooked, clamped, injected, and balled in the ping pong of sonic graffiti. Language is useless rubble. Your tongue makes garbled syllables. My throat, a three-chord refrain, waiting for you to pick up a word, waiting for life to begin again. The end.
When I listen to you, there seems to be a qualitative difference between the way that you speak and the way that you share your work. What is the relationship between your speaking voice and your written voice?
Okay. I don't know. I think when I'm speaking, I am inhabiting the same world as you are inhabiting. I'm reading, I'm inhabiting the world of the poem, and it's always been like this. It's interesting that you say that. Everyone else has also said that your speaking voice and the reading voice is completely different. That's because these two worlds are like, they exist side by side. The world, the poem creates its own universe. And it's always been like that for me.
I'm just stunned. I really like what you said.
Thank you.
Share another poem, please.
Yes.
Share another poem.
This is another. I'm continuing with poems relating to the pandemic. This one is called Death Sentence. Vermifugitives in the apocalypse, slow boiling ambient anxiety, mouthbound, stopgapped at the abyss. It's all hit or miss. Draw blank, arrive at terminal punctuation, an epic collapse. Or skirt the hem of the precipice, squirreling soap and opiates, coughing up the last of your dough, an epic lapses, leaning, groaning, cartwheeling, snaking lines, stuffed to brimming. Here the I and the you go haywire, quarreling over the last holy roll. Will the toll finally bell the cat that's out of the bag and on our cursing pack of lips? Oh, Corona, Medusa of microbes, turning love into gauntlet and cheeks to touch me nots? We, who are raised on barbs, eking out a bleak dime, appearing, disappearing moon from hollow throat of rolled up toothpaste tube. We, who ride deadly rapids of cash registers, softly straining under harnessed breath, ask only this. Oh, Corona, why us? We are weary of crownings, craving nemesis, a goddess to erase, self-tanning orange puffer fish kings, swimming in shallow hubris, twiddling thumbs on Twitter, steering ship of state to dire straits, peddling lies, muddying waters. Enough of Neros and their fiddling. Lead them to the well, Corona. Watch them caress the crow's feet of their face. And as Narcissus leap into their own reflection, leave no markings. The end.
I view you as being exceptionally creative.
Thank you.
What does being creative mean to you?
Creative means to be continually examining the possibilities that can be present in language. It means just never being satisfied. I'm never satisfied. I'm constantly pushing myself. I'm constantly thinking about language. I think if I wasn't a poet, I'd be an etymologist.
Okay.
Because I'm in love with language. I'm in love with the endless permutations and variations and all of it. So.
All right.
So. Well,
continue, please.
Yes. So when we're continuing in that vein, you know, Corona, this epidemic, I don't know if you have heard that it's also triggered a wave of racist violence against people who look Asian or Chinese, and
yes.
You know. So I'd written a poem which is called Send Her Back. And you may have recalled a certain individual saying that at his rallies.
Yes.
So this is called Send Her Back. To hit the nail on the head, index finger of your right hand, barely a millimeter of tenuous crescent, enough to scratch and sniff salt air of Chaupati, where bite-sized moons are meant to be swallowed alongside of spice liner ocean, the whole gob smack in your mouth, sounding cathedral gold of Seville, Columbus holding up the globe, Gloria, while bells toll, galleys and holes unmasking human cruelty across skin and bones. 400 years later, steering clear, yet pulled over like wool, the mammoth root of all unholy trails. The end.
You know, they say that to see the world with complete honesty, one should look to comedians, artists, and poets. What do you think emerges naturally from your work?
I think what emerges naturally is my life experience. I've been and lived in 22 cities in my life.
Oh, wow.
I have experienced exile. I have experienced dislocation again and again. I've experienced unimaginable loss again and again. And I think it kind of strips you down. There can be no artifice, and there can be no, how should I say, compromise at that point, because as the old song goes, when you've got nothing left, you've got nothing left to lose. So that's what I fall in those parameters.
Right. So who are you as a result of those experiences?
I think I'm a more honest person as a result of those experiences. I think it's just gotten you down to what is essential in life. I think that humility is essential. I think hope is also essential. I think hope, but also looking at others and understanding how we're all connected is essential, especially now. You know, if there was ever a time when, you know, the philosophy of America first was shown to be patently ridiculous, when xenophobia was shown to be patently ridiculous, because guess what? The virus knows no borders. there is no wall that can keep it out, you know. So we realize. So I think that my ethos is that we need to re-examine our culture of, and this goes for everywhere throughout the world, our culture of toxic nationalisms. You know, it's nationalisms that are destroying the world. You know, it's this is me and this is mine and this is my tribe and my nation and me and my. That's so. You know, if you step away from the planet, as all the astronauts, you know, that have said, that, you know, you realize there are no borders, you know. We're all one planet, and we are destroying it at a very disturbing rate. And paradoxically, the virus has made the planet is so healthy for the planet. So what's unhealthy for us is healthy for the planet. But I hope And I pray, even though I'm not a religious person in that sense, I hope and pray that the lesson that we can learn from this is we have to be better stewards of the planet, and we've got to find some kind of balance between our life and the life of the planet. It's not just, it can't continue as it is, the endless exploitation.
You know, again, your work is exquisite. Do you think that you were meant to be a poet?
Very interesting. I actually had a scholarship to go to art school, and I had to go to work at the age of 19 full-time to support my family. So I never actually ended up going to art school, and I don't know. It's what happened. Who knows which way your life would have ended up, you know, but the path that came in front of me is the path I've been on. I have to say that I, you know, I still paint, and I still, I have many interests besides poetry as well. And I should also mention, in the context of the virus, that my day job, and something that I am also passionate about, is my work is helping people with traditional herbal medicine from India. So we have an organization called, a nonprofit organization called Kaya Kalpa. And so we are helping people right now with that. My ethos is to be of service in whatever way I can. So at kayakalpa.com, we offer, you know, free consultations through April 30 for people who are stressed out and are trying to deal with this whole pandemic that is causing stress. And, you know, I'm digressing from poetry, but stress,
it's okay,
is what causes you to become weak and your immune system to suffer. So whichever way you can find an oasis of calm and peace in these troubled times, whether it's by taking a walk or by listening to a poem, all of it is so, so needed at this time.
I agree 100%. And the name of your company again? And its website?
It's called Kaya Kalpa Foundation, Kaya Kalpa Alchemy Foundation. And we're on the web. We've been here for 40 years. I've been doing this for the last 30 years.
Wow. Thank you for sharing.
Oh, thank you for making me talk about more and more about stuff that is actually quite important in this present
context.
Yes, it
is. It is. It's extremely important. Another poem, please.
Okay. Since you're talking about the climate, here's one about. It's called Uppercase. The rain empties her pockets in your mailbox. Rivers flood, plains eons old with no return to send her on the other side of the teeter-totter. A wilted sapling dies, another poet wishes, word magic could weave carpets of water to wrap around Amazon's bleeding hell. A spell to pull tuxedoed pandas out of top hat of sky, to multiply species at the end of their tether, to make better weather. On soil, oil-covered egrets, clean oceans clogged with plastic, coax glaciers back into ice at mouths of rapid melt and drip, feed the starving polar bear cubs with fat snowflakes of love. You were taught that words rule worlds, logos cures all sins, In the meantime, endure, endure, parched monarchs unable to secure a life-saving boon of milk thistle. Is there a cone for bleached bones of the Great Barrier Reef? For each stem and leaf consumed by greed, when earth is subjected to capital punishment, is there an uppercase big enough to contain grief? The end.
We'll be right back. Back. I am here with the incredible Sophia Nas. Sophia.
Yes.
All poets have several words that come up over and over again. Words or sentences that they just can't help but use in their work. What are three of your absolute favorite words to use?
First and foremost, tongue. Comes up again and again, and it's one of my favorite words. And the next one, I would say line. Line is one of my favorite words because it has so many meanings. Everything from, you know, standing in line to, you know, the line that you descend from, to the line that you write, to the, you know, in Washington it would also mean the line item veto. So I think the third favorite word, I guess, well, it's a toss-up between time and memory, and of course those two are related to each other, but those are some of my favorite words. And so speaking of tongue, this is a poem called Mother Tongue.
All right.
Mother Tongue, take off your shoes outside the shrine where ghosts of the mother tongue reside alongside lamps of extinguished geographies. Should I gauze this dhaka muslin today, say mal, mal, glaze a homonym hymn in Kabir's cadence over an earthen plot of amputated thumbs? Warp and weft, pour from the cleft, mandible as tomb, sanctum sanctorum, womb of wombs, mother tongues ferment. Matryoshka dolls, each within another, mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, till the last pod God, embedded, seed, syllable, whales. Ma, mother of memory, heal me and make my prosaic days of bricks, troll boots, malware, endless fishes, click by click the dick pics box me in, anarchally, sentenced to snark alley by that blind emperor, autocorrect. The walls are closing in, transfixed on a selfie stick. Mother of memory, ma, reveal me, a heaving loom, the greater grid buried in these lines, electrify a thousandfold suns in the mouth of every silence. The end.
The title of that particular poem again?
It's called Mother Tongue.
Mother
so
Tongue.
There's a few things to unpack here. There's Mulmul is to mull in English means, of course, to think. But Mulmul is also a very fine muslin. And so it's a homonym, therefore, that line, the homonym hymn. And the Mulmul in question, you know, we're getting back to history, in Kabir's cadence. So Kabir, I'm not sure if many of your readers might be familiar with Kabir due to the translations of Robert Bly. He was a poet, but he was also a weaver. So he, a lot of his metaphors come from weaving. And the earthen plot of amputated thumbs refers to colonial times when our British overlords were so jealous of the fine fabrics produced by the weavers of Dhaka that they amputated their thumbs so they would never be able to produce that amazing fabric again.
Wow.
So that's some unpacking as to what was in that poem. Again, as I said, history is an obsession with me. So we can't understand how we got here unless we are cognizant of how we got here.
Yes.
So.
Yes. You know, when you think about writing a poem, what are some of the most prevalent ingredients that go into the concoction we call a poem? What's the ingredients go inside a poem? Go into making a poem?
I think, first of all, it's how I'm feeling at the present moment. Because a poem is primarily, for me, a vehicle to express what cannot be expressed so neatly. So it is me trying to unravel the puzzle of life as I perceive it through the greater puzzle of language, because language is a very interesting thing, because poetic language works in many ways in opposition to normative language. Instructional language is very efficient in saying, here's how you get, here's how you unpack the box, here's how you assemble the table, here's how you get from here to, you know, Rockville or wherever you're going. The poem, as Emily Dickinson famously said, is telling the truth, but telling it slant. And she goes on to say, success in circuit lies. And this is the heart of the poem, is how you can convey what you're saying without destroying it. In other words, it is like there's a famous photographer who said, photography is the art of making the camera see what the eye can see. So I consider poetry as the art of making the page or the or your expression reveal what normal language cannot express. So it's a riddle, you know, and it's a riddle that each poem presents a particular problem. And I wrestle with it. Sometimes I wrestle for hours, sometimes I wrestle for years, but it is, each one is a quandary, something that sometimes it's never solved, and I, you know, I present it as it is, and it's my attempt to lay out what I feel about something and how it could possibly be presented in strings of words.
Well, with that in mind, a string of words, please share another piece of your work.
Okay. This one is called 33 Inuit Names of Snow. Light travels at 68,000 miles a second. Ergo, even as your lover's eyelash brushes your cheek, a glimmer has passed into dark, diurnal wells where you go like village girls to draw water for these lines. When you wake from wetness, clocks are dismantling silence like taxidermists. They push pins into sky's chameleon feather, mining the amoebic belly of water to cash in on a quick rainbow. Everyone's watching for a pot of gold, while you are dreaming of a deep silence folded in the 33 Inuit names of snow. What is love, if not something that alights on the tongue? Snow is the language of osmosis, synonym of a teaspoon of star soup from the first stirring, the eons old light swimming like eels in your veins. The end.
Your poems have amazingly detailed titles. What role should a title play for a poem? And what advice would you give beginning writers about titling their work?
I think that the title does play a very important role because it shows that you have done the work. It shows that you have thought about something that sums up. It should try and sum up, or it should try and jolt the reader out of their sleep-waking state. Because mostly readers, especially these days, tend to have short attention spans, and if you can grab their attention at the very beginning, it's very helpful. My advice to young poets is just, poetry is the art of paying attention. The more you pay attention, the better you will get at it. Paying attention to your surroundings, paying attention to language, paying attention to your feelings, trying to find what it is, because everyone has a frequency. Everyone's frequency is slightly different because, you know, we all came out, we all have a teaspoon of star soup, but the rest of it is, you know, yes, the rest of it is pretty unique.
Have you taught poetry classes before?
No, I haven't taught poetry classes. I was today, April 1st, I was actually scheduled to be in New York for a poetry festival in which I was supposed to actually teach a workshop in Stony Brook University. Of course, everything's canceled. So, yeah, I haven't taught. I haven't even, you might be, to be quite honest, I've never gone to college. I had to go to work full time at 19, so I'm completely self-taught. So
incredible. I can't believe that.
Thank you.
Wow.
So we're almost at the end.
Yes, we are.
I think I might have room for one last poem, and that's an important one. It's called Lineage.
Well, let me ask you this one last question. I got two questions,
actually.
Yes. Writers and poets write for a myriad of reasons. Some write primarily to speak a message to their audience. Others write because to stay silent is not an option. Why do you write?
I write because staying silent is not an option. I would say that there's two very different kinds of poetry that I write. I write very linguistically dense and somewhat hard to understand poetry. I didn't read, basically didn't read any of that today, because there's two very different kinds of poetry. And the one that is extremely linguistically dense and sort of hard to understand, full of double, triple entendres, full of homonyms, full of bilingual homonyms, things that mean different things in different languages, that is kind of a hallmark of my work. I didn't read any of that today, very little bit in the one that was Mother Tongue, because there's great, I mean, the kind of poetry I'd read aloud, what works on the written page doesn't always work
aloud
in a spoken setting. So I've modulated what I do write. So I write a really diverse kind of poetry. I write formal poetry, things that are called ghazals, very formal South Asian traditional form of poetry that's metrical and it's weighted, and I write totally experimental stuff that you wouldn't understand. You know, the normal person would have to decode. So very different. There's a great deal of experimental stuff that I write as well.
All right. Share your poem, please. Share your poem. I look forward to hearing it.
Okay. Lineage. Before you were born, she skimmed your boundary. Mother of all stripes, linea negra, a lean line, simple as the clean cut that popped you, squeak and pip of two signature lines. Cradled in timber, the line grew shape. A skipping scribble float the malvi, twisting your naughty ear to still of bay, made slender letter boat anchored by a single nukta. The point being that slowly you were made to form lakir ka fakir, the line that would fill your life as water does a glass. This much was clear. Must memorize, repeat line after line. No loving in this repeating, which brings us to lineage, conundrum at hand. Look under the womanhood, the line you must not cross is given, circumscribed. It hems you in from head to toe, the line is manual, precipice, edge, abyss, endless delineation of knots and crosses. Ash Wednesdays, the forehead withers, season after season. Red and unread lines are everywhere. Demarcations of otherness, the puzzled dashes of word processors helpless to corral Alif Layla under their spell. When the line fell in love, it became a couplet. Radif and Kafia eloped a ghazal, that briefest of springs, lingering in between the margins. Even as the line stops galloping on the electric page above the hospice bed, slumps two sad elbows, becomes the four lines of the coffin, a quatrain from whose walls there is no escape, only passage. The end.
You know, when people hear your work, I'm sure they want more. What's next for you as a poet?
So I have just completed a manuscript, my latest manuscript of poems, which were written after I had lost my home in the 2017 fires.
Yes.
And that is called Zero Period. And it is actually seeking a publisher.
All right. Very
any
nice.
Publishers out there. some of the poems were from that collection, Zero Period. I've just finished it, and I continue to write. I write every day of my life.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank you for being a guest on the show.
Thank you
Fantastic.
So much. It's been such a pleasure.
Fantastic. Well, to our listening audience, thank you for being with us, and we'll see you next week. All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night, Michael.